At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce our two speakers. Erica Lee is an associate professor of history and Asian American studies at the University of Minnesota. The grandchild of immigrants who came through both Angel Island and Ellis Island, she grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area and is the author of the award-winning book At America's Gates, Chinese Immigration During the Exclusion Era, 1882 to 1943. Judy Young, Professor Emerita of American Studies at UC Santa Cruz, is the daughter of Chinese immigrants who were detained on Angel Island. She worked as a librarian and journalist in the San Francisco Bay Area before joining the faculty at UC Santa Cruz. Her award-winning publications include Island, Poetry and History of Chinese Immigrants on Angel Island, 1910 to 1940, and Unbound Feet, A Social History of Chinese Women in San Francisco. Angel Island, Immigrant Gateway to America, is the official publication commemorating the centennial of the Angel Island Immigration Station. Book proceeds benefit the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation, a nonprofit organization that has worked for over 30 years to preserve, restore, and interpret the U.S. Immigration Station, a National Historic Landmark. The foundation conducts research about the history of the Immigration Station and disseminates the Angel Island story as widely as possible. Would you please join me in welcoming tonight's speakers?
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here at the Commonwealth Club and to be part of this fabulous program. We've been speaking around the state and soon to be across the country about Angel Island, but it's always a pleasure to be back here in San Francisco to talk about Angel Island when it's just across the bay. And it's especially wonderful to be able to discuss Angel Island's immigration history this year, its centennial. On July 31st, we were privileged to be able to be on the island during the official centennial celebrations. There were 1,300 people who braved the seas on the ferry boats to come with us, and it was a wonderful day. I'd like to start tonight by talking about one of the Chinese poems that were carved on the walls of the immigration station barracks. I clasped my hands in parting with my brothers and classmates. Because of the mouth, I hastened to cross the American Ocean. How was I to know that the Western barbarians had lost their hearts and reason? With 100 kinds of oppressive laws, they mistreat us Chinese. This anonymous Chinese poet speaks to us from 100 years ago. His poem reminds us that in the early 20th century, the Chinese Exclusion Act barred Chinese laborers from coming to the United States. Additional laws barred Asian immigrants and restricted others, including Southern and Eastern Europeans. Back then, immigration was a complicated and contentious matter. Of course, the great debate over immigration continues today. Just recently, Arizona passed a law authorizing local police to detain people they suspect of being in the country illegally and requiring immigrants to carry papers proving their legal status at all times. Some senators are even proposing that the U.S. Constitution be changed to deny birthright citizenship to children of undocumented immigrants. You pick up a newspaper, you listen to the news, and it's clear that today's headlines and opinion polls suggest that Americans are generally in an anti-immigrant mood. Immigrants are seen as taking away jobs, not assimilating into American society, and being a drain on the American economy. Juxtapose this image, this anti-immigrant view, with the popular understanding that America is a nation of immigrants built by immigrants. The story of the 12 million immigrants, mostly from Europe, who passed through Ellis Island, entered the United States, and achieved the American dream is one of the most enduring and often told chapters of American history. But then how do these two different perspectives on immigration, the Chinese Exclusion Act and the Arizona law on the one hand, and the celebratory Ellis Island story on the other? How do they fit together? Of course, in reality, the United States has always had a complicated and controversial relationship to immigration. Not all immigrants were equally welcomed to America's shores, and not all immigrants were able to achieve the American dream. The Angel Island Immigration Station, the National Historic Landmark, celebrating its centennial this year, helps us to better understand this more complicated history. It also helps us to answer an essential and very timely question. Immigration is said to be a mirror or a window into a nation's national identity. So is the United States a nation of immigrants that welcomes newcomers and helps them to achieve their dreams? Or is it a gatekeeping nation that builds fences and detention centers to keep out aliens that it identifies as undesirable and dangerous and unfit to be Americans? The Angel Island story tells us that the United States is both. But which America immigrants encountered was determined by economics, by politics, foreign relations, and often the newcomer's race, nationality, class, and gender.
Judy Young here. I'm sorry my voice is cracking. I'm still recovering from a cold, so I hope my voice will last through this presentation. You know, from 1910 to 1940, San Francisco and the Angel Island Immigration Station served as the entry point for over 500,000 people from 80 different countries around the world. Now, two-thirds of these immigrants were from China and Japan, but there were immigrants also from India, from Russia, from Korea, Mexico, the Philippines, Germany, Spain, Central and South America, the Pacific Islands, Australia, and New Zealand. While Angel Island was popularly called the Ellis Island of the West, the immigration station was in fact very different from its counterpart in New York. Ellis Island enforced American immigration laws that restricted but did not exclude European immigrants. Angel Island, on the other hand, was the chief port of entry for Chinese and other immigrants from Asia, and as such, it enforced immigration policies that singled out Asians for long detention and for exclusion. The fates of the immigrants when they arrived at Angel Island were in the hands of the immigration station's inspectors, clerks, and interpreters. These self-proclaimed gatekeepers decided who would be admitted and who would be excluded. Most immigration service employees were diligent and fair-minded, but there were those with prejudices, and they gave certain groups of immigrants a harder time. Well, in 1940, a fire that was caused by an overloaded circuit burnt down the administration building, and the immigration station was moved back to the mainland. The buildings that were spared in the fire were abandoned and slated for demolition until this park ranger by the name of Alexander Wise, walking through the empty buildings one day, noticed Chinese writing on the walls and called this attention to the Asian American community in San Francisco. For the next 40 years, community activists and descendants of Angel Island detainees recovered the history of immigration through Angel Island. They successfully lobbied for National Historic Landmark status, which is very important to make sure that the buildings would remain standing. They also secured funds to restore the site and to embark on a massive preservation project. They wanted to call national attention to Angel Island as a symbol of America's multiracial history of immigration and as a site of conscience and reconciliation.
Until recently, what we have known about Angel Island has focused almost exclusively on the Chinese immigrant experience. And this has made sense in many ways. The motivation to build the immigration station was largely grounded in the country's need to enforce the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. This law barred Chinese laborers. This is the first time in U.S. history that the United States had barred an immigrant group based on their race and their class, and it really laid the foundation for other restrictive immigration laws to follow. These laws had a devastating effect on Chinese immigration, but in spite of them, Chinese immigrants did not stop coming altogether. Instead, those who were still exempted from the law continued to come. Those included merchants and students, teachers, travelers, and diplomats, as well as their children and wives. Another way in which Chinese immigrants came was to come as the so-called paper sons and the paper daughters of these exempt class immigrants by circumventing the laws with false identities, relationships, and fraudulent documents. The first immigrant group to be restricted from the United States, Chinese immigrants, became the first so-called illegal immigrants. When they arrived in the United States, they met immigration officials who were intent on restricting Chinese immigration as much as possible. Chinese immigrants were first singled out for invasive and humiliating medical exams. Then they had to endure long and intensive interrogations about minute details regarding their family background and village life to verify their identities. The answers of the applicants and witnesses were compared for discrepancies that could justify exclusion and deportation. If you go to the National Archives and look at some of these immigration files, some of them are inches thick because of the number of questions and the back and forth between witnesses. The Chinese made up the overwhelming majority, 70% of the detainee population at the immigration station, and their average stay there was the longest, for two to three weeks. For some immigrants, Angel Island represented a real time of anguish and despair. Take the tragic case of Chinese immigrant Soto Shi. She arrived at the immigration station from Hong Kong in late July of 1924 with her seven-month-old son, Sun Din. They were coming to join her husband and Sun Din's father, who was a merchant in Idaho. While in detention on Angel Island, little Sun Din died suddenly. His body was brought to San Francisco for burial, while Soto remained detained on the island. She suffered from grief. She pleaded with immigration officials to be allowed to go to San Francisco with her husband, but they denied the request. 3 weeks later, in the middle of the night, Soto Shi tried to commit suicide, and she hanged herself in the women's bathroom. Had it not been for the immigration station matron who was making her regular nightly rounds and found her, cut her down, unconscious, and took her to the hospital, Soto Shi might have died. Her husband renewed efforts to get her admitted into the country, and she was eventually allowed to leave the immigration station. She went on to raise 10 children and lived to be 96 years old. We've been giving these presentations about the book in several different cities, and Soto Shi's many, many descendants are following us around listening to this wonderful story of survival and perseverance. Soto Shi's Angel Island ordeal and the many Chinese poems written and carved into the barrack walls by angry, frustrated, and homesick immigrants are powerful reminders of the costs and hardships of immigration under such a discriminatory regime. They are also evidence of resistance and perseverance, and it is this immigrant spirit that draws hundreds of thousands of visitors to Angel Island every year.
But we also found inscriptions on the walls left by other immigrant groups as well. The preservation efforts of the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation have uncovered writings in German and Japanese, mainly by POWs who were housed there during World War II. Also inscriptions in Hebrew, in Russian, in Spanish, and Italian, and in Punjabi, Korean, and English. This inscription was by Tara Singh. He left it in two places at Angel Island, and in the other place he said he had been detained for 9 months. Unfortunately, we could not find Tara Singh's immigration case files at the National Archives to know his full story. We also saw photographs collected together that showed us the global character of immigration through Angel Island. This particular photo was taken by Catherine Maurer, who was a Methodist deaconess on Angel Island from 1912 to 1940. She tended to the needs, taught English classes, and provided materials and comfort to women, men, and children. She titled this The Leak of Nations, and this photograph was published in the Women's Home Missions in 1920. And you could tell by the captions that there was a diverse range of immigrants coming from different countries in that one photo alone. These other photos of a Turkish mother, of an African woman, these photos led us to ask ourselves, who were these immigrants? Where did they come from? What were their experiences like on Angel Island? And what do they tell us about the real impact of American immigration policy in the past and in the present? We also interviewed as many Angel Island immigrants and their families as we could find. We combed through newspapers, letters, and published accounts. We searched through thousands of immigration files at the National Archives in San Bruno. We chose a treasure trove of immigration documents, statistics, correspondence, and over 70,000 case files of immigrants who were once detained on Angel Island. These historical records told us that many immigrants were admitted, but some were turned back, or they might have been detained for months to await decisions on their legal appeals after being excluded. Still others were arrested and deported after being admitted into the country, and we know that immigration inspectors at Angel Island participated in these investigations. We also looked at O Immigration Station blueprints, and they showed us that racial and gender segregation was strictly enforced at the immigration station in order to keep whites and Asians, men and women, separate from one another. There were separate waiting rooms in the administration building. There were separate living and hospital quarters. There were separate dining facilities and different eating times. And there were also separate recreational areas for the Asian detainees versus the European detainees. What struck us most in all of our research was the diversity of the immigrant experiences on Angel Island.
For example, Wang Chenghong, a Chinese merchant for admission into the country in January 1910, was the first recorded person to be admitted into the country after being detained on Angel Island. We wanted to find out who was the very first immigrant detained on Angel Island because in doing research on Ellis Island, we knew that the first immigrant who passed through that immigration station was a woman named Annie Moore from Ireland. And she celebrated in song, in the newspapers. There's a big statue of her on Ellis Island. But there was no such marker for the first immigrant on Angel Island. And we thought that was an important story to recover. So in looking at Wang Chenghong's immigration files, we could see that he was certainly a member of the upper classes. He has richly embroidered robes. His immigration documents from the Chinese government and the U.S. consulate were in order. His genteel appearance all convinced immigrant inspectors of his upper-class status. He was admitted after 3 days at the station. In contrast, Mexican immigrant Esther Lopez, her husband, Catarino, and their children were unanimously excluded as likely to become public charges. This was a specific legal category in immigration law that barred anyone who was believed to not have enough funds to support themselves who would be on welfare once admitted. Immigrant inspectors believed that the family had, quote, a very poor appearance and would not be able to support themselves. They looked at Catarino and they wrote in his file that he was thin and scrawny looking and not at all rugged. Esther was in her last trimester of pregnancy, and they thought that she would presumably not be able to work. While detained on Angel Island, Esther gave birth not to one baby, but to twins, to two, at the station hospital. The family's Sacramento relatives launched a defense. They came to visit them at the immigration station. They tried to enlist the help of the Catholic Church, but immigrant inspectors could not be swayed. The Lopez family was deported back to Mexico after 3 months. So in these two cases, class made all of the difference. Immigration officials also treated women differently from men. Women were routinely excluded as public charges and asked intrusive questions about their sexual lives, while men were not. This was because women could be excluded as prostitutes or as persons who were guilty of crimes of moral turpitude. That was another legal category of exclusion. Their right to enter was also based on whether or not their husbands could support them. Their own ability to support themselves was not considered relevant. This is the case of Rose Lewis. She's a white English woman married to Emil, her husband, a black ship steward from the island of Mauritius near South Africa. They had sailed in from Hong Kong in 1918. And immigration inspectors excluded her as a person likely to become a public charge because Emil had failed his literacy test. After 1917, immigrants who could not pass a literacy test were also excluded. Rose's argument that she had been working as a stewardess and could support herself, and that the family was only passing through the United States on their way to Canada, failed to change the minds of immigrant inspectors. The couple and their 7-week-old son were detained on Angel Island for 6 months and then deported back to Hong Kong. So in these three examples, we have already Wang Changhong from Hong Kong, the Lewises from England and Mauritius, the Lopezes from Mexico. Another 500,000 immigrants came from 70 other countries from around the world. And the big question that we had to ask ourselves was, how did they all end up on Angel Island? And once there, why were their immigration experiences so different? These are the questions that we hope to answer in writing this book.
So the Chinese were the largest group at Angel Island, 100,000. The second largest group were 85,000 Japanese immigrants. Now, in contrast to the Chinese, they had an easier time in terms of their length of stay as well as the interrogation process. And that was because Japan was a rising imperial power at the time, and they had earned the diplomatic respect of the United States and was able to protect the interests of their citizens abroad. Whereas they negotiated a gentleman's agreement with the United States that allowed Japan to control, to stop the out-migration of Japanese laborers to this country. The gentleman's agreement also allowed Japanese immigrants here in the United States to send for their wives and children from Japan, whereas the Chinese Exclusion Act forbid Chinese laborers here from sending for their family. So when Japanese immigrants arrived with these passports issued by the Japanese government and also with marriage and birth certificates to prove their immigration right to enter, the majority of them, including 10,000 picture brides during this period, were admitted within a day or two. The Japanese had the lowest deportation rate among all the immigrant groups at Angel Island. Less than 1% were rejected and deported upon arrival. However, sometimes returning U.S. citizens of Japanese descent, such as Gozo Yoneda, would get caught up at Angel Island. Yoneda was a Kibei, someone who was born in America but educated in Japan. He had left for Japan with his family as a young boy. He decided when he turned 20, he would come back alone to America in order to avoid the Imperial Army conscription. He said after 16 days of being crammed in the steerage quarters of the ship, he finally arrived in San Francisco, only to find out that his cousin was too busy with spring planting to come and testify on his behalf. So Gozo Yoneda ends up being stuck, locked up on Angel Island for 2 months, waiting for his cousin to show up. And he writes about his experience at Angel Island in his memoirs, Ganbatte. The first chapter was entitled Angel Island. He said he spent a monotonous time at Angel Island reading Japanese newspapers and books, and he also wrote poetry, waka poetry, which were 37-syllable poems. And although none of the poetry that we found on the walls were written by other than Chinese, there were no Japanese poems, we did find Yoneda's poetry in the Nichibei newspaper published in San Francisco. In 1927, as you can see, their sentiments similar to what the Chinese wrote on the walls at Angel Island, talking about how Angel Island was a prison, that it caused tears of sadness, tears of anguish, and yet he also talked about hearing voices of other immigrant groups right next to his cell, which told us again the diversity of immigration through Angel Island. Well, finally, Gozo's cousin, Okamura, shows up. And after a brief interview with the immigration inspectors, he was allowed to leave the island. He would go on to become a very famous labor organizer by the name of Kara Yoneda. Aside from the Japanese, there were at least a thousand Koreans who also sought admission through Angel Island. They came in fewer numbers because after Korea became a Japanese colony in 1910, Japan forbid the immigration of Koreans. They didn't want Koreans to go abroad. They were fearful that Koreans would join the independence movement abroad and help to overthrow Japanese rule in Korea. So the Koreans who were able to leave had to do it in the same way that Wang Sa-sun and his wife Chang Ta-sun chose. What they did was to go across the North Korean border into Manchuria, disguise themselves as Chinese, make their way to Shanghai, and in Shanghai they bought passage on an American steamer so they could come to America via San Francisco. And because when they arrived, they had no passports and they also had no visas, they were detained on Angel Island, usually for at least a week to 2 weeks, arguing why they should be admitted. And the way they did that was to say that they were students. Many of them were refugee students, but they didn't have student documents, so immigration inspectors would interrogate them about their educational background and to what school they would be going to in America. They also argued that they had left Korea before 1910 to go to China, and because of that, they were not Japanese subjects, because this was before the annexation. Well, fortunately for many of these Korean refugees coming at this time, there was a sympathetic Department of State under William Jennings Bryan who sided with their arguments and allowed most of them to be admitted. They also had the support of the Korean National Association in San Francisco, which is a very strong ethnic organization with the financial resources and legal help to help many of the Koreans get landed. In the case of Wasa-sung, he settled in San Francisco, where he opened a dry cleaning shop, and he became the minister of the Korean Nationalist Church in San Francisco and a prominent leader in the Korean independence movement. Aside from students, there were also Korean picture brides who came in the same way that the Japanese picture brides came during this period.
There were about 8,000 South Asian immigrants who came to the United States in the early 20th century. Most of them were Sikhs from Punjab in present-day Pakistan and India. They left their homes to escape poverty and also British colonialism. When they arrived in the United States, they faced an American public that was ready to oppose any more immigration from Asia. The San Francisco-based Asiatic Exclusion League pressured immigration officials to stop the so-called Hindu invasion. This is a cartoon that was published in June of 1910 in the San Francisco Daily News, and it's representative of the types of images and illustrations and public sentiment around immigration from South Asia. So here it's covering the efforts by the Exclusion League to pressure immigration officials on Angel Island to enforce the laws as strictly as possible. One of the problems that the Exclusion League faced was that there were no laws barring South Asian immigrants until 1917. And so what they did was to suggest to immigration officials to use that likely to become a public charge clause as much as possible. But in this cartoon, you can see the ways in which the Exclusion League thinks of South Asian immigrants, that they are something less than human. They've got gorilla-like hairy arms, feet, and hands. They are wearing turbans, so clearly exotic and not assimilable. Their clothes are really rags that are covered with bugs. So not a class of immigrants that could easily be assimilated or that the United States wanted into the country. They are brought here by the fat cat industrialists, the capitalists with the top hat who is welcoming them into the Pacific coast. And behind them is an endless wave of ever more Indians who will just keep on coming unless the United States closes the door. These public attitudes about South Asian immigration had a real impact on Angel Island. South Asians had the highest rejection rate amongst all groups at the immigration station. From 1908 to 1920, 66% of all South Asian applicants were rejected, usually on the grounds that they were likely to become a public charge. The first commissioner of immigration, so the first head of the Bureau of Immigration on Angel Island, was Hart Hyatt North, who was a California assemblyman. He lived in Oakland. He is the one who is responsible for getting the immigration station up and running. And the Exclusion League felt that he was much too soft on South Asian immigrants. They labeled him, or they nicknamed him, Sahib North. And they started a campaign, a letter-writing campaign, with petitions to call for his removal. And a year after the immigration station opened, he was fired because San Franciscans thought that he was too soft on South Asian immigration. The other problem that South Asians faced was that few had the financial resources to appeal the exclusion decisions that the immigration department was handing out, nor were there any ethnic organizations to assist them. And of course, the British government, which ruled over India, could not be counted on to support Indians abroad. Vaishnav Das Begay, his wife Kala, and their three young sons were an exception. They had no trouble being admitted into the country in 1915. Vaishnav was a very well-educated man from an upper-class family in Peshawar in present-day Pakistan. The family was immediately landed after Vaishnav showed immigrant inspectors that he had brought $25,000 in cash with him to the United States. So that likely to become a public charge clause would certainly not apply to him. But they had arrived in San Francisco over the weekend when the immigration station was closed, and so they were detained there for 3 days. Vaishnav had come to the United States because he was part of the Gadar independence movement. This was the Indian nationalist movement that was advocating for the overthrow of British colonialism in India, and because he wanted his children to grow up in a free country. He adopted Western manners, he bought a home, he started a successful business right on Fillmore Street, and he became a naturalized U.S. citizen. But 13 years after his arrival in the United States, Vaishnav was a different man. He was bitterly disappointed in his adopted homeland. He saw that fellow Indian nationalists were arrested and deported from the U.S. He saw that South Asians were prevented from owning land or property. This is after California and many other Western states passed the so-called alien land laws. And he also saw that the Supreme Court had stripped South Asians of their naturalized citizenship. Feeling trapped and betrayed, he committed suicide by gas poisoning in 1928. He left two letters, one for his wife, Kala, and another that he gave to the San Francisco Chronicle. In this letter, he explained his actions. "I came to America hoping to make this land my home, but now they come and say to me that I am no longer an American citizen. What am I? We cannot exercise our rights. Obstacles this way, blockades that way, and bridges burnt behind." After Vaishnav's death, Kala struggled with everyday tasks of surviving in a new land and caring for her three young boys. All eventually went to college, and soon after the ban barring South Asians from naturalized citizenship was lifted in 1946, Kala and her sons became U.S. citizens.
There were approximately 8,000 Russians and Jews who also passed through Angel Island. Because of the wartime conditions in Western Europe, many had to journey east across Siberia, China, and then across the Pacific to reach America. They were farmers and laborers who were seeking economic opportunities, aristocrats and intellectuals escaping political persecution after the Bolshevik Revolution, and there were also Jewish refugees seeking a safe haven from pogroms in Russia and also from Hitler during World War II. Now, many of them arrived as refugees, penniless, and with very little cash, and thus they were mainly excluded on the grounds of being likely to become a public charge. But in their cases, there were so many religious and ethnic organizations, like the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, that were willing to help them, that very few of their appeals were denied in the end. They stayed at Ein Zion for no more than 2 or 3 days, and less than 2% were actually, in the end, deported. However, those who came after the Immigration Act of 1921 was passed had to stay at Ein Zion for at least 2 or 3 months. Now, this was a quota act that was passed mainly to stop further immigration of immigrants from southern Eastern European countries. Russia, for example, after 1921, had a quota of 2,600 per month. So once that quota was used up, those arriving would have to wait for the following month's quota to open up before they could be admitted. Otherwise, they could also be deported back to where they came. This is what happened to 23 Russian students who arrived in 1923. And they wrote about their experiences locked up on Angel Island for about 3 months while waiting for the quotas to open up. They wrote articles and poetry and sent it back to their classmates in Harbin, China, where they had come. And they talked about how good the food was compared to what they had gotten on the ship. They talked about how they enjoyed visits on a daily basis from friends and their lawyers and from social workers. And they also talked about being given permission by the immigration authorities to do musical concerts and theatrical plays at the immigration station for the benefit and enjoyment of other white detainees and staff. So this is very much in contradiction to the dismal living conditions that the Asian immigrants wrote about. And yet they still resented being locked up indefinitely behind barbed wire, as indicated in this particular Russian poem that they wrote and sent back to Harbin. It was published in the Rusky Colors newspaper in 1923. And you can see they're talking about Angel Island, as the others have, about having to sit behind bars with the guards watching them all the time. They cursed immigration, they cursed Angel Island, and they cursed the League of Nations for not doing enough to help Russian refugees and for not doing enough to help overthrow the Bolsheviks in Russia. Well, in 1938, after Germany invaded Austria and Czechoslovakia and turned to state-sanctioned pogroms to drive the Jews out, over 140,000 German and Austrian Jews fled their homelands to find refuge in Western Europe, in China, and abroad. Now, based on the ship's manifest, passenger list that we saw on microfilm at the National Archives, we know that at least 500 of these Jewish refugees did reach San Francisco from Shanghai and from Yokohama in 1939 and 1940. They all talked about Shanghai as being the one place in the world that allowed Jews into their country for seeking refuge, that no visas were required. Among these who were able to reach San Francisco was Alice Edelstein, who we were able to interview before she passed away 2 years ago. Before her father first escaped to the Dominican Republic, he wrote to every Edelstein that he could find in the U.S. telephone directories, and he asked them if they would not please help to sponsor his wife and his daughter to come to the United States. There was one family, one Edelstein family in Milwaukee, who responded and agreed to help, even though they were not related by blood. So they were able to process all the paperwork and to get visas for the Edelsteins, for Hilda and Alice Edelstein, mother and daughter, to come to the United States. But by the time they got the paperwork, it had already been a time when Italy had entered the war, and the Mediterranean route, which they would have taken, which would have been an easier route to reach Japan, the coast, the Pacific coast, had been closed. So what happened is Alice and her mother Hilda had to take the Trans-Siberian Railway from Moscow all the way to Vladivostok, 6,000 miles away. They were only allowed to take a few American dollars and whatever they could carry with them. From there, when they arrived at Vladivostok, they took a ship to Kobe, and there they joined 100 other Jewish refugees from Vienna on the Wakua Maru, bound for San Francisco. When they arrived, 75% of those who came on that ship were allowed to land. They had the necessary paperwork. But the Edelsteins were taken to Angel Island because they had no money to buy train tickets to get to Milwaukee. And as such, they were deemed likely to become public charges, detained on Angel Island for 3 days, waiting for money to come from their sponsors. And so finally, they were released once they got the money and were able to buy train tickets. Alice later married an engineer and had 3 children. She decided to move from Milwaukee to Oakland, California. She said she always remembered Angel Island as being the most beautiful place on earth. "I was lucky all the way," she said in an interview. "A great part of my family, who were older, all died in the Holocaust, and I missed them dearly. But you know, that's the way it was."
Most immigrants applying for admission into the country from Angel Island came across the Pacific. But Angel Island also welcomed immigrants traveling north from Latin America, including those from Guatemala, El Salvador, Panama, Nicaragua, Peru, and Chile. Between 1900 and 1930, 1.5 million Mexicans migrated north to the United States to join family, look for work, or to escape the Mexican Revolution. The vast majority, of course, came across the U.S.-Mexico border. But we know that at least 400 refugees came by sea from Mazatlan, Salina Cruz, and Acapulco to San Francisco. This was because for many years, the sea route was a much safer way to leave the country than across the border. One of these refugees was Maria Lopez. She had fled Guadalajara, Mexico in 1919 after her husband was murdered by political opponents right in front of her eyes. She fought off the attackers herself while protecting her infant son, Miguel. This all happened in a hideaway barn. Soon after she fled the country, she took the first ship leaving from the coast. She didn't know where it was going. It just happened to be heading towards San Francisco. By the time Maria and Miguel arrived at Angel Island, both mother and child were sick. They were detained at the immigration station for 2 days before being admitted into the country. Maria found work as a domestic servant and as a governess. She later married Joe Gargiulo, an Italian-American, and settled in San Rafael, where they opened up the county's first Mexican restaurant and had 3 children together. Among the last to arrive on Angel Island were Filipinos. While the Philippines was a U.S. colony occupied since the 1898 Spanish-American War, Filipinos were considered U.S. nationals. This was a specific legal status that also applied to Puerto Ricans. It meant that Filipinos did not have to be subjected to U.S. immigration laws, but they were not U.S. citizens, and they could not become U.S. citizens, or could they vote in any election. In 1934, all of this changed. The Tidings-McDuffie Act was passed. This act gave nominal independence to the Philippines, but it also made Filipinos aliens or foreigners and subject to the nation's immigration laws. So between 1934 and 1940, there were at least 1,000 Filipinos who were detained on Angel Island for short periods of time. They were either waiting to be admitted into the country as new or returning immigrants, or they were waiting to be deported back to the Philippines as a result of the 1930s repatriation campaigns during the Great Depression. This is when the U.S. government asked Mexicans and Filipinos if they would like to return to their homelands In return for a free ticket to Mexico or the Philippines, these migrants had to promise that they would never try to enter the United States again. There's records that this repatriation campaign, which was supposed to be voluntary, had some less than polite consequences, that there were some who claimed that they were coerced into leaving. One of the Filipinos who came through Angel Island was Alicio Felipe. He came as a new arrival. He recalled his first trip to America in 1933, when Filipinos were allowed to freely enter the country without going through an immigration inspection. "There was no inspection," he said. "I just got off the boat. It was like getting off the bus." But when he returned to the United States from a visit to the Philippines in 1940, things were different. Filipinos had to go to Angel Island to enter the country. Alicio was shocked to be detained on Angel Island for 2 days and interrogated about his finances. Fortunately, he had a savings account. He had life insurance policies. He had a letter from his employer. He was an apartment bellboy here in San Francisco, saying that he had a job and that he was not a public charge. When he volunteered for the U.S. Army during World War II, Felipe was granted U.S. citizenship. He remained in the military for 20 years, got married, and raised a family in Salinas, California.
Well, Alicio Felipe was among 500,000 immigrants who passed through Angel Island. The immigration station was not only the America's Pacific gateway, it was indeed a global crossroads. But what do all these diverse stories tell us? While the number of immigrants passing through Angel Island pales in comparison to those who passed through Ellis Island, it is Angel Island and its greater racial diversity that best illustrates America's complicated relationship to immigration then and now. Angel Island complicates the celebratory history of American immigration that focuses only on European immigration through Ellis Island and achieving that American dream. The poems that are carved into the barrack walls of Angel Island and the former detainee stories of unjust treatment at the immigration station force us to also confront America's history of immigration restriction and discriminatory immigration laws. Angel Island was important in its own time, and it is still important today, when debates over immigration and race continue to divide the country. Immigrant detention is the fastest form of incarceration in the country today. In 2008 alone, 407,000 immigrants, mostly U.S. residents, were detained by the U.S. government, with incarceration periods ranging from 37 days to 10 months. Now, you compare this to the total of 300,000 immigrants who were detained at Angel Island during its whole 30-year history, and with an average detention period of 2 to 3 weeks for the Chinese. And we know that things have gotten worse today than better. It's clear to us that immigration will continue to be a major political topic in this year's midterm election, in the White House, in local communities, in the halls of Congress, as America tries to fix a broken immigration system. Angel Island represents both the best and the worst of American history. It's the story of men, women, and children who crossed the Pacific Ocean and traveled north from South America to establish new lives in America. It's also the story of harsh and discriminatory immigration laws and of immigrant perseverance. And it is the story of a place that became a gateway to America, forever changing the lives of immigrants and of America itself. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
We'd be happy to take questions if anyone has any.
Thank you. Can you tell me a little bit about the facility in San Bruno where you uncovered these files. How did they happen to be in San Bruno, and what else was that facility used for? Thank you.
It's the Pacific branch of the National Archives. So we know about the National Archives in Washington, D.C., which holds our Constitution and other founding documents of the United States, as well as the documents of our federal government from its beginning. But the National Archives also has regional branches around the country. And the one that covers San Francisco, Northern California, Hawaii, is based in San Bruno. There's also regional branches in Seattle, Laguna Niguel, Chicago, et cetera. So the National Archives has all of the documentation, well, much of the documentation of the federal government based in this region. And we looked at the immigration records for the Port of San Francisco. These records are what we like to call the silver lining of the Chinese exclusion era, because most immigrants and their descendants who came through Ellis Island have very little documentary evidence to fall back upon, to research their family histories. At most, there's the ship passengers list. There's also some wonderful oral histories that were done in the 1980s. But because the federal government was so invested in maintaining a paper trail on every Chinese immigrant who came in, their business, their schooling, their neighbors, their relatives, that they created these files on them that covered, that spanned their lifetimes. They, you know, when Chinese Americans were living through the period of exclusion, they called it a reign of terror because of the constant surveillance that they felt that they were under. As historians, these documents are amazing evidence of not only the effects of exclusion on the Chinese American community, but also their perseverance. With us tonight, we are privileged to have Marisa Louie, who is one of the archivists at the National Archives in San Bruno. And I don't know if, Marisa, if you wanted to say a few more words about what is held at San Bruno. Do you want to come?
Described pretty well.
Okay.
I am the staff archivist who works with folks who are researching their family histories. So if you or if folks that you know have family who passed through Angel Island or who came to San Francisco before or after Angel Island, we can look through our records to see whether there are records that pertain to them. And I can assure you that no one, you know, walks away saying that that's it. You know, everyone is very surprised typically to find what is held in these files, photographs that they've never seen before were lost to their families. You know, the interviews that Erica and Judy have spoke of, and so on and so forth. So I left a stack of my business cards outside, so if, you know, you're all welcome to take those business cards and to pass my contact information along, and I'll be available to talk after the Q&A is finished.
And I also think because of the interest of the government in keeping track of the local Chinese-American community, we have more records on the other immigrant groups here in the San Francisco area than you have, for example, in New York. So that's the other silver lining of exclusion. Yes. Oh, here.
We have the microphone first.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I just would like to understand just the logistics. So if someone were excluded, who paid his passage back to China, and on what kind of ship was he sent, and so on? I just can't picture. The ones who got in, I have some vision of, but it sounds to me like there were many who were excluded, and I just can't picture what that process was. Thank you.
We calculated, based on the 300,000 immigrants who were processed to Angel Island, that in the end, only 7% were sent back to where they came. Now, I should also add that at Ellis Island, it was something like 2% were finally deported. But it was just the long detention and the special process that the Asian immigrants particularly were subjected to at Angel Island that was the ordeal. And so they would have to file appeals to protest their exclusion and wait for months sometimes at Angel Island for the decision to come through the courts. And at the end, they were admitted, but it was that long wait and the anxiety and the additional expense of hiring an attorney to represent them that made the immigration process so much more arduous and difficult for them. So the 7%, if they tried to get in and appeal the decision and still were deported, the ship that brought them would be responsible for paying for their return trip. In other words, when they buy the passage on the ship, it includes, if they're detained longer at Angel Island, the ship pays for their room and board, and also, for the board, for the food, but also if they're in the end deported, the ship is also responsible for paying for the return. So the immigrant doesn't have to come up with more money to be shipped back, and the U.S. government does not pay for their return trip to where they came from. So it's all included in that way. They don't always go back on the same ship, of course. So what happens is once they've determined that they're going to be excluded, they're going to be deported, then they wait for a ship that's going back to Hong Kong or Shanghai, wherever they came from, to come into port, and they will be put on that ship, and then the ship that they originally came on would be responsible for paying for the return trip back. Yes. 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 And for the Chinese, the way it worked is that the one amount that they pay initially to a broker would include not only the round-trip ticket, if they had to come back, but it also would include the coaching notes and the identification papers. So the rate was for my father, who came in 1921 as a paper son. It was $100 per year. He came as a 17-year-old paper son of a merchant. He had to pay $1,700 for that ticket. That's a lot of money, and it took him almost 10 years to pay it back. Fortunately, he passed the interrogation, did not have to put out more money to hire an attorney. That would have been more of a debt for him to pay beyond the $1,700. And they mostly came on steerage, which was the cheapest way to come. And when you come on steerage, you automatically practically go to Angel Island. That's why so many of the Chinese and the poor immigrants who came by steerage all ended up at Angel Island.
I just wanted to make a comment when we were talking about the National Archives, that I had gone there about 20 years ago and researched my father, and I found the ship, Siberian Maru, where he had come from the Philippines in 1921. And it was a ship manifest that was found there, and his name was first. That was a thrill for me.
Well, I'd like to ask the question, since I own the microphone right now. Professor Lee, we were speaking before, and you mentioned that they're still discovering artifacts and things to some of these folks, and you mentioned what was found in Seattle. Maybe you could recount that story a little bit.
I think that was a story about recovering the history of the Seattle Japanese American community after World War II. Judy and I just came back from Seattle to give a book presentation, and we were in a cafe that used to be a hotel right in the middle of Japantown. And after World War II, of course, when Executive Order 9066 had been issued and all Japanese residents were forced to relocate, first to relocation assembly halls and then to internment camps, they left in a hurry. They left many of their belongings behind. They were only allowed to bring one bag each. And so many of their belongings were lost to these families and to the community. After World War II, in this particular hotel, there was some renovation going on, and the people doing that work discovered dozens of trunks and boxes full of personal belongings, baseball bats, account books, clothes, yearbooks, and those have been preserved up in Seattle. And I think similarly, there are many discoveries, historical discoveries that that we in the Asian American community have been making over the past 30 years. The poems on Angel Island was certainly the iceberg to this larger Angel Island immigration story. The oral histories that Judy and her colleagues did in the 1970s were another piece of that story. And we like to think of this book as the latest chapter because it has expanded beyond the Chinese American community to include this amazingly diverse group of other immigrant groups. And in doing the research, it had inspired us to go into communities, to do oral interviews, to see photographs. In one case, there was a book from a Japanese-American minister who recorded the marriages of picture brides and others. So some of these artifacts are making their way to the Angel Island Immigration Station for preservation, and some of them are still yet to be discovered. I wondered how many people have actually been to the immigration station. So about half the room. Yeah. It's worth a visit.
Hi. Obviously, more Asian immigrants came through San Francisco because that was the proximity of it. If an Asian immigrant ended up at Ellis Island, would they have been treated differently because the policies of Ellis Island were different, or was it an Asian Exclusion Act so they would have been treated the same on either side?
It's yes and no. I think in the introduction, Cynthia mentioned that I have grandparents who came through Angel Island, and I have grandparents on my mother's side, who's sitting right behind you, who came through Ellis Island. And there has not been enough research done on the great diversity of immigrants who also came through Ellis Island. So we know less about non-European immigrants who also came through that crossroads. But the little research that I have done in both places suggests to me that it was very different on Ellis Island. The same national laws applied. It's not that, you know, if you were Chinese, you could be admitted without any problems in New York. But there is a culture of suspicion and a culture of restriction that had been in place in San Francisco, which is the birthplace of the anti-Chinese sentiment, the movement. It was where this this campaign to restrict Asian immigrants began and then spread to Washington, D.C., so when we look at the paper's immigration officials, for example, many of them in the very early years who had been actively involved in advocating for exclusion ended up being immigrant inspectors and would enforce the laws accordingly. So in comparing Angel Island to Ellis Island, it seems to me that the same national laws were enforced, but there was a difference in how they were enforced, that there wasn't the same level of suspicion that was embedded in New York. We also found in comparing the Russian experience in San Francisco and New York that that was also different, too.
Yeah. I think looking at particularly Russian Jews coming through San Francisco, because, you know, you read about the accounts of those Russian Jews who came through Ellis Island, and there was anti-Semitism. They were more roughly treated. There was a higher deportation or exclusion rate in New York compared to San Francisco. It was twice as high. Exclusion and deportation of Russian Jews in New York was twice as high as in San Francisco. I could find no evidence of anti-Semitism in any of the correspondence reports and the case files. I looked at least 100 files, and they're labeled Hebrew, so you know these are the Jews who came through Angel Island. I could find no evidence of mistreatment or anti-Semitism. If nothing else, based on the transcripts, that the immigration inspectors were quite sympathetic. They knew that they were coming as refugees, and even though there was no Refugee Act in place at the time, they were going to be subject to the same general immigration laws as other immigrants coming through from Europe. They were quite lenient in comparison to the way they treated other refugees from other Asian countries, for example. And I do know that there was Chinese poems also left at the Ellis Island immigration station. I know at least a couple that have been found, and there might have been more. So that indicates to me, too, that the reason why Chinese would end up writing the poetry as they did in Indrawana is because they were stuck on Indrawana for long periods, for at least 2 or 3 months, and they were the ones that wrote the poetry. And also because they were the most frustrated, angry among all the Chinese detainees. And to see poetry expressing similar sentiments in Seattle at the immigration station there that was just closed 2 years ago and at Ellis Island tells us that that they may have been more lenient in some way in terms of the culture against Chinese immigrants, but that that the laws applied and that there was also same kinds of resistance feelings of anguish and frustration at being treated and at being detained for such a long period at Angel Island as well as at Ellis Island. I'd like to also take the opportunity while he walks through the next person to mention that we have the website of the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation as on our last slide. Just to tell you this, that would be a good source to go to for additional information, history, and immigrant voices on their webpage. And also, it will also give you information about what you will find if you were to go to Indrawan today and visit, because they have done a fantastic job in the last 20 years fundraising and hiring designers and historians to restore the site and make it into a premier museum. Not quite in the stature of Ellis Island, but certainly close. And they are continuing to fundraise and to finish this in the next few years, hoping to raise another $30 million to complete the process of the other buildings in the area.
Well, thank you very much, Judy Young and Erica Lee, for a wonderful, informative presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.